barely hear you over here.
Oh, sorry. If you could introduce, just offer your name and introduce yourself. Yeah.
Ian.
I'm Lucy.
My name is Jeremiah. I don't know how much you want to know or what kind of information you want to know about.
Your name is fine. That's fine.
All right,
yeah.
My name is Jeremiah.
Okay. Here, he's going to be our guest speaker. We're going to be talking about net neutrality.
What is net neutrality?
I'm glad you asked. Excellent segue. So what is it? The idea behind it is that it's the principle of non-interference of internet content. Content on the internet, those who provide content on the internet, the internet service providers as they're called, are not to interfere with the content that they receive. They can't make preferential treatment. In days of yore, by which I mean before 1980, you would have heard the term referred to as common carriage. The idea that, and a principle referring to the phone industry, that telephone companies, by which until 1983 meant telephone company, before the AT&T breakup, were not to interfere as far as what phone calls, once an exchange was made regarding a receiver and a transmitter of a thank you of a telephone call, they were supposed to carry that without any kind of further preferential treatment, even no matter what else happened, no matter what, even if the content might not be something they may like or might be something they don't like. Same deal regarding net neutrality. It's the principle of non-interference of internet content. I might, and in fact I have, organize against big internet service providers, the Comcast, the AT&Ts, the Verizons, because they, and have actually had plans for, we'll be getting about more into this in a moment, arranging preferential treatment on the basis of money, because they had seen, going back for plans that have been released going back at least the last 6 years, that they could stand to make a lot more money if they were to provide preferential access. The more you pay, the faster service you got, conceivably the more content you could receive. That, however, would run afoul of a whole lot in the way of freedom of speech outside of the First Amendment. And so that's why there's been a pretty serious struggle going back at least the last 6 years or more on this. I'll be talking about that more in a moment. So that's your basic definition of what net neutrality is. Non-interference of content on the internet. Obviously, you have to obey laws, and there are all kinds of other considerations regarding that for other speech, but it's the idea, the principle is that those who transmit that internet content are just basically to serve as dumb pipes in the internet parlance, to transmit the content without fear or favor of any content they may prefer or not prefer. The history about this actually is kind of the latest extension of history of media and corporate involvement of media, you could argue going back at least the last 170 years in America. Going back all the way to the telegraph of 1844, it goes back that far, you have seen the creation of various communicative media followed by the corporate encroachment upon that media. In medium after medium after medium. I actually gave a presentation about this back in January. You can hear the audio about this in a presentation that's recorded online at the website of Chicago Media Action, at chicagomediaaction.org. You can look up the podcasts and find the audio there. Look for a presentation called Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles, where I gave a capsule summary in about an hour of about 230 years worth of American media history. And that is, since 1840 on, that has unfortunately been a great main concern and main pattern regarding media. You have a medium that's invented, and then increasing corporate control, and their great genius of corporations is not so much in the technical sphere or in any kind of sphere involving media, but basically in political lobbying, to basically take whatever could be made profitable, use their lobbying might, and then ultimately seize control for their ends. to the detriment of everyone else. And that, by which I mean the vast majority of people in the United States. And if you look through the history of media in the United States, that's been a clear pattern. From the Telegraph in the 1840s to the advent of motion pictures in the 1890s, going through about 1920, to the emergence of radio as a main medium in the 1920s and 30s, to the subsequent emergence of television in the 1930s and 40s, the internet is basically the latest chapter in this whole sordid pattern. Going a little bit more into detail regarding the history of the internet and net neutrality, the internet itself dates to, you can actually say all the way back to about the 1940s, with the emergence of what was referred to as ARPANET, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, the branch of the U.S. military that was tasked with the problem, what would happen if the United States was attacked in a nuclear war? How would communication work? How might it work? And the brainchild out of that was what was referred to as the ARPANET, a distributed way of communication, mostly along telephone lines. If in the event one or more nodes, as they're called, basically dots connecting lines on an imagined graph, were to be wiped away because a nuclear bomb blows it up, for example, how would it work? The result was basically what was the precursor to the internet called the ARPANET. The internet itself, or what we know about it, dates to about 1969. In fact, the very first email that was actually sent was a single failed email between, let's see if I remember this, it's Stanford University to UCLA. A single one-word email, the word login, which wound up failing. It actually got to the G and then the server crashed. But that's where the emergence of the technology began, and the development was built over the course of those subsequent years, in the 1970s, 80s, with the emergence of additional technologies, additional protocols. You would find a number of key developments in the increasing corporatization of the internet. In 1990, you had a closed-door meeting that took place at Harvard University. A lot of the details of that still are secret, but it basically amounted to, at least for what scholars seem to believe, a partial privatization of the public internet backbone between the government and the incipient technology industry that was occurring. In 1994, you had the beginning of the emergence of the dot-com boom, when dot-com domains outnumbered .org or .net domains for the first time. The trend would continue to escalate throughout the 1990s, heightened to no small extent in 2002, when the Federal Communications Commission made its first salvo in demolishing the principle of non-interference by reclassifying the internet in such a way that common carriage provisions would be less respected. In nerd wonk parlance, they refer to it as a Title II reclassification. The upshot of it meant that the internet as the kind of non-interfering medium could potentially be interfered with, ultimately by corporations who would stand to gain monetarily from it. That's where that first salvo began in 2002. It worked its way through the courts, going all the way up to the Supreme Court in 2005, when a case brought before the Supreme Court, an internet service provider out of California called Brand X, had actually filed suit claiming that the FCC had no right to undo that authority, which the argument was not accepted by the Supreme Court, and so that ruling then stood, which then meant that opened the door for new legislation in Congress, and that was the fight going on in 2006 tremendously. I was very heavily involved with that. If you go to our website, you can learn a great deal of our history and involvement in that. In the first attempts to protect net neutrality, which I'm happy to report succeeded. But that was not the only salvo. In fact, there were attempts to undo the FCC's authority, mostly in the courts, which had a big success last year when Comcast had beaten the FCC at a federal court level to undo the FCC's remaining authority on net neutrality. That then was undone with a subsequent action just this last December, when the FCC then said, okay, well, here's our second attempt at a new net neutrality law, which a lot of people criticized as basically being too weak and full of loopholes and didn't protect wireless provisions, and especially where more and more people are going to be using wireless and are using wireless as their main means of using the internet. that was one heady criticism a lot of people had. That is currently being sued. Verizon has now taken that up. Unfortunately, the court that was assigned to that, hearing that, was actually the same court out of D.C. that actually struck down the FCC at the Comcast ruling a year before. A lot of people seem to think that the odds aren't going to be this much better this time around. We'll see. Congress just last week actually took up a provision to overturn the FCC's action in a resolution of disapproval, as it's called, which I'm happy to report actually also failed, narrowly though. It actually lost in the Senate by just 8 votes. But this is the kind of, a little bit of a primer going back to what it means to its to the larger context of its history and to the more recent takes on this. But and there's a lot more I could get into, so that's where you all come in. There's a lot I've kind of given here, and a lot of this may have gone over your heads. If there's anything I'd like to explain or that you need unpacked or whatever, let me know. Thoughts?
Can you explain the Title II
reclassification? There are a number of provisions in communications law that basically assign where certain media lie regarding what principles or what laws could be allowed. There are two key that are here of interest for the internet, Title I and Title II. Title I is what's referred to as an information service. It basically means that any kind of media is a free-for-all and anything goes, at least as far as provisions for content or discrimination are concerned. Title II is what's referred to as a telecommunications service. And that's the idea of where larger networks, particularly where the public is critically involved, usually it had been referred to by telephony, and it increasingly was where, up until 2002, the internet had been at play. The idea of common carriage provisions and non-interference of content lie. Unless you have a really good, serious reason to screw around with that content, you do not do that. But as I mentioned, back in 2002, the FCC had undone that provision. The guy who was responsible for that, for the most part, was the then chair of the FCC, Michael Powell, who's the son of former Secretary of State Colin Powell, who served at the FCC for 4 years and actually now is the head of the National Cable Telecommunications Association, the main lobby on behalf of the commercial cable television broadcasters. So yeah, it was basically his doing, and unfortunately this has been part and parcel of the FCC's history. FCC staffers, including commissioners, almost overwhelmingly wind up going into high-paid, high-profile positions in the very media they supposedly regulated. Michael Powell is one of the more recent examples of a long, sordid history in this regard. But going back to the Title I, Title II provisions, it's basically that classification that is critical here, because any lawsuits that come to fight the FCC on this ground hinge critically on that reclassification basis. And so the FCC could very simply say, we're going to reclassify the internet back to what it had been as a Title II provision, where that common carriage applies, and those lawsuits that Comcast and Verizon, whoever else may bring up to bear, might not apply, and probably wouldn't apply. And so that's where that becomes a critical dimension in this whole saga here. And this is an explanation that took me just 4 minutes to unpack for a single question. Fitting this into a soundbite is enormously hard. So that's been part of the struggle here about getting people up to speed on this front to know what's going on, never mind how it's important and how it could affect people's lives. I saw a hand there first, so one, then two.
Okay, if you're not use computer a lot, I don't have a computer, if I want to do some stuff, I go a lot. what interest is it in for me to know about what this is?
Good question. I don't use it for people who don't use the internet, but here's a follow-up question. Do you have any access to any communicative medium at all? Thank you. Do you have a television set?
Of course.
Do you have a radio?
Yes.
Congratulations. Those are two media that are increasingly going to go digital. And by which they mean, since they are digital, and television in high broadcast situations for the last 2 years has now been all digital.
Yeah.
You can't get it now if you don't subscribe to that digital regime. That's going to affect you. And it's not going to be just that. The entirety of our media apparatus will increasingly go digital, which will mean that even if you don't have a computer, under the hood, that will affect you. And so that means that those policies will also affect you, even if you don't know them or don't care about them. How? Okay, here's an example. In the case of broadcast television, there is the potential of it going digital means that there are a lot more potential channels that can be. Those channels could mean an increased flowering of available television bandwidth for community television, for example. Except that the people who had the broadcast licenses, mostly the incumbent television broadcasters, who didn't exactly get that by fair means, I will say. And there's a long sordid history in the story about how that happened. But that basis of that increasing communicative bias means that basically the same people who called the shots on the previous television regime in analog will also have that same bias as far as digital. But there's no technical reason that should be the case. And that kind of goes to the question here about how that should happen. With more and more channels, that should mean that, okay, you can have your channel 2, 5, 7, 9, whatever. You've got an additional bandwidth of potentially 5 channels, could grow up to as many as 20 over time, that could be used for other means. So, okay, have your channel, keep that. We'll take the rest of that, or potentially could take the rest of that, for any of a number of different potential uses, or use it as a potential sandbox, as has been discussed at federal levels, so that new communicative media could be built on top of that in ways that hadn't been invented. I mean, remember, the iPhone, to mention one technical example, is just 4 years old. Something like YouTube is only 6 years old. Who knows what technical marvels that are in development now could, in just a handful of years, become huge and influential, and also, hopefully, in ways that affect people beyond just, you know, technical nerds who are interested in the under-the-hood tinkering of this stuff, but everyday people who would like to participate in this way, but who are interested in driving a car, but don't want to learn how everything about how an engine works, to use another metaphor.
Okay, so you kind of lost me. I still don't understand
okay.
How it would affect radio or television in any way. And I guess my question is just related to that, because I feel like a lot of us have to net neutrality for many years, and we all know that it's bad. And it seems like most people I talk to don't have an understanding of what it is. So how is it that we can actually make the language accessible to everyday people so we can understand this threat? Because now the internet is so much part of our everyday lives, and my understanding is that it would impact how we experience using the internet, but I really don't have any understanding of why. There's just a real big
okay.
challenge, I feel like, in terms of the kind of language that you use to explain this stuff. And,
you know
what I'm saying? So I'm just, that's my question.
Right.
How would it impact radio and television? And also, I guess, another live example is, so the other day, you know, the cops went and they evicted the Occupy Wall Street protesters.
Right.
You know, my question was, if net neutrality was overturned, how would it impact all of us getting that information right away?
Right. No, totally. I'll bring up an example, actually, from the history of media, and a kind of good thing I kind of mentioned that at the early outset. I'll mention radio as an example. In the 1920s, when I'll go back to, let's say, around 1921, let's say, and if you were among the relative few who had a radio receiver and wanted to listen to radio stations, you had a wide swath of different radio stations, different radio choices, a lot of communities, groups, institutions, even everyday hobbyists, who were putting on tremendous amounts of content on the radio receivers that you could freely pick up with your receiver. That changed with a dramatic reshuffling of the given regime. It was referred to in technical parlance by the Federal Radio Commission, the body that preceded the Federal Communications Commission, as General Order 40. It basically referred to a forced reallocation of the radio spectrum so that the incumbent commercial radio broadcasters and radio commercial radio broadcast manufacturers would get the choicest frequencies and the greatest potential radio bandwidth. And that wound up, in the course of the subsequent 7 years, all but killing that community broadcast spectrum and the basis that they had.
So can I just talk about
Yeah.
So you're saying that radio was similar at one point in time to the way the internet is today, or any of us can be media makers on the internet?
That's the fear and that's the potential there. You could, and especially now with a lot of tools that are increasingly available to more and more people, you could go on WordPress and in a matter of minutes create a blog, and with your genius writing skills and brilliant repartee and wit, could create a blog that, with a lot of people seeing it and with, you know, Google being an influential resource and finding content with people, especially if you're talking about content that people are interested in now, that potential from going from nothing to potentially huge is a relatively small step as far as your potential involvement. You would have to, in the case of getting a single ad on a radio station, have to somehow have or own tens of thousands of dollars to buy a single radio ad. Most people, generally speaking, don't have that kind of money laying inside their couch. And that's what, going back to that example of radio, that's where that potential lies. You didn't need to have tens of thousands of dollars to be independently wealthy to be able to utilize that medium. But that forced reclassification, and there was a serious struggle going on during the subsequent 1920s and 30s to try to undo that, which unfortunately failed. And that's a whole sordid history in itself. But you get the idea there, that whole potential ramp up, that any of us could become that world-changing broadcaster or whatever. And that's how that Occupy Wall Street kind of fits into this. If that whole regime, if in a different internet world, many people would never have known about Occupy Wall Street to begin with, never mind to know about its, you know, violent crackdown and so forth. And you damn well know that, you know, the major media, the establishment, and the big banks all wanted to go away, and they would do a lot to hide that history so that people would never again talk about it, aside from, you know, people in rooms like this.
In fact,
Yeah, you had your hand up.
It's censorship. Since I was 12, I was annoyed with the so-called free country, and then other people are deciding what I'm going to see. It's all about that. I was at Colin Powell's kid deciding what I'm going to see or listen or hear to. Digital is wonderful. On my digital radio, there's a little tiny station. I mean, they're popping up all over community. Some are better than others, but it's fun to just DX through.
Right.
And I am here because censorship. The other day when the government for Homeland Security made sure they could cut off the TVs like they do in China. When they're annoyed, they turn it off.
You're talking about the attempted emergency alert system attempt from last week.
Yeah, that bothered me. I mean, what are they going to do to help it? That's so stupid. Bend over and kiss you know what goodbye. Duck it. It's stupid. But my neighbors say, wonderful Homeland Security. No, it's censorship. And everything.
That's the very real fear.
The newspapers are crap.
Look, I can go through 170 years of examples if you want. I mean, listen to the audio presentation. I mean, censorship, not the least of the matters.
Oh, right.
But that's the very real fear and the threat that's posed by this and the net neutrality fight that we've been fighting and had some victories on. I mean, just last week, the 2006 fight, I can go on, but you get the idea.
I think the heart of it, back to your question is, what if somebody that doesn't make any use, like an active use of the internet, The existing technology, it exists, they can block all of this. A perfect example was this recent eviction of Occupy Wall Street. It's amazing they got anything out because they had Verizon blockers. They had fans that blocked the signal so that the media was blacked out of that particular thing. So the technology exists that will completely control what we can and cannot see, what we can and cannot broadcast. The question at hand is do we want to give them permission governmentally to be able to do that whenever they feel like it?
And
doing it, they're doing it, I mean, in that situation, that whole eviction process in New York is an iffy thing because technically it's not a freedom of speech issue because it's on private property. And it gets a little wiggy, it gets a little crazy. But the reality is, they can do that anywhere. They could block our internet access right here. They could come in, we could have SWAT teams walk into this room, just declare this gathering an illegal gathering. And my first impulse is I want to call somebody, or I want to Twitter it, or I want to get some information out. They block that access, then we're stuck in a room with a SWAT team that tells us we have to sit here and we have no access to anybody. We don't have radio, it's mostly do we want to give the tools to major corporations to be able to control that at will? And I think that's where
the policy question comes into play. That the fact that there's the technology aspect about it. Here's technology, there's an iPhone technology. Clearly that's a component here. But you're wrong to think that it's the only component, or that by focusing only on that you've won the fight. On the contrary, you've had, going back at least 170 years, instances of technology after technology thinking that the next thing is going to be the thing that's going to take it over, ignoring the political fight behind this, and thinking that, and you're going to lose that political fight. In the last decade, we've seen that emergence about people taking that political fight seriously. And as a result, because they've done that, they've been able to win those political fights. And that's been, I'm hoping to write a book about this. I might make it an ebook, who knows, about my own personal involvement in the history about this. If you go to the website, chicagomediaaction.org, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, another technology, you'll see the whole history about people not just letting these things go to chance or just pretending that technology is going to be the be-all, end-all, but realizing that there are political fights behind this. And by getting involved in those fights, you stand a much better chance to win those fights. I've been living that lesson year in, year out for the last decade. And I hope you do too.
Can you clarify something?
Yeah.
So is it that they would block you as the content creator, that you would have to pay certain fees in order to create content on the web, so you couldn't just go to WordPress and do a blog by yourself? Or is it that you would have to pay to access certain websites, so they're categorized in particular ways, and then, you know, to access liberal content or whatever, that would be more expensive than, you know, Children's Place or something like that?
The fear is that both might happen. And in fact, when you actually look at some of the designs that, for example, go back to a spreadsheet that SBC had announced before it actually bought out AT&T and took that name, they had released to, and actually anyone could download this because they made this available to potential investors, and they actually drew up what they basically were planning out. And they basically said, yeah, we're going to charge in every direction we can. If you produce content, we're going to charge you. Download or consume content, we're going to charge you. And we'll probably do it in striations, tiers as they called. In fact, we actually, in 2006, when we had organized a protest outside of the SBC office on Congress Plaza, and we coordinated that with about a half dozen other protests nationwide, we called our protest Bringing Us to Tiers, T-I-E-R-S, is a pun on this whole policy arrangement. But yeah, they do it in, you know, give them an inch, they'll take a mile any way and every way they can. Right.
Is Google behind something, Yahoo, any of the larger search engines, do they have anything to do with it?
were the players at play? Good question. The main players against net neutrality have been the main internet service providers. And the big three are Comcast, Verizon, AT&T. You also have a number of routing companies. These are the companies that produce the machinery that transmit the packets, the atoms of information that actually travel on that internet backbone. Companies like Cisco and like other hardware companies that actually transmit those packets, as they're called. And it had been going into, actually were in their own investment portfolios announcing, oh, we can get down to micro packet levels and be able to, at levels of maybe billions of packets per second, classify things for your tiering system that you're planning. So that was another component there that was slanting the cash in big,
so
potentially.
Is it that the speed would be slower to access certain content when that certain content would be denied to you?
All of the above. It's speed, it's accessibility, it's maybe even very well the content of what's being provided. I mean, the plans that were drawn out were pretty extensive and across the board, and probably in other ways that people hadn't envisioned yet. The main content providers, so that's like the Microsofts, the Googles, the Yahoos, the companies that kind of had a pedigree, for the most part, in these technologies and kind of built themselves on a kind of neutrality platform. I mean, Google didn't go to the government or to AT&T to ask for permission. You had two guys in a garage in Palo Alto, California, who dropped out of grad school to start this company up that within a matter of mere years wound up literally changing the world to the point where now Google's a verb.
So what if people moved away from the larger internet providers? You know, there was a movement in, like, San Francisco, it was called Free Internet, where you had to put the router outside your house. And
right. That is a possible solution, but you also find various hurdles and obstacles related to that. So, like, for example, one effort that was afoot mostly for the last decade, and you found that efforts even here in Chicago to do that, of various local community internet infrastructures, so that it wouldn't be a main corporate internet service provider. You would have a municipality that would call the shots regarding this. And you actually find a little bit of a infrastructure about that. That of cities that actually were able to some extent to successfully do that to some extent. There should have been more, and there was a pretty serious fight back and forth about how that should happen. It didn't take off to the extent that I think it should have, I think also because you would find local interference lobbying efforts by these main, mostly corporate ISPs and other various power brokers who wanted to diffuse that before it could become a serious threat. I think there's now a little bit of a trend to returning to that as a possible viable option, seeing as how the grand promises that the main ISPs had made that thought would become into fruition now haven't. And so they're thinking, well, why not try this again? You also have a lot of unused technical background infrastructure, like what's sometimes referred to as dark fiber in certain places. That a lot of the infrastructure was built in the 1980s and the 1990s for the potential use of serving as a kind of internet backbone that just never got used. It could be used, and maybe someday will, but until such time as the various power brokers, like the ISPs, like local governments, like the Ciscos of the world, either get defeated in the political fights over this, or something else dramatic happens. And you never know. I mean, we've seen dramatic things happen even within this past year. That's still up for grabs.
You heard me, right?
Yeah.
So, as an example, I get information from Public Square.
Mm-hmm.
So, if this goes through, something like this will go through, then they only have to pay to send out the information?
Potentially, yes.
Council,
yeah.
Right.
Now, to be clear that you, I mean, here's an example. I just last week sent a check to my internet service provider, a company out of upstate New York, that I pay $140 a year to maintain my presence on the internet. my website, the website of Chicago Media Action, two separate websites, as well as email and email list infrastructure, and as well as server space. So I can actually, since I actually work as a software developer as my day job, I have that technical infrastructure so that I can code in my spare time. Now, clearly there are costs. That's a cost there. But that's, at least for me, a reasonable cost, and one I can certainly afford. Most people probably could afford $140 a year. But when it comes to, in the case of, let's say, buying a TV app, tens of thousands of dollars just to even get your foot in the door. And even then, it's not a show. There are plenty of examples of, you know, nonprofit groups that realized, okay, the only way we're going to get on CBS Evening News is if we buy an app. Okay, let's spend 6 months and raise $500,000 to do that. And then they do that. And then they say, okay, here's our ad. Here's the money to buy it. Give us ad space. And then they say no. Because they say, and they make up some baloney excuse. It's too political. Usually it means that that's a political orientation they don't like or don't agree with. But that's where that real fear there is regarding the internet. That it could eventually, over time, become that chasm that television and radio became, that the internet could eventually also become. And where this whole political fight now, I think, is so crucial. And I'm very heartened everyone is here involved in this. Yes, sir?
Are you familiar with Ray Kurzweil works?
I'm sorry, what?
Ray Kurzweil,
yes.
Okay, what do you think that perspective, that his singularity perspective as far as technology playing within this role of trying to govern technology? Because that's what it seems.
Right.
They're trying to govern technology because I can understand both sides of the argument of protecting government and also the fear of people of different ideals and people, because it's kind of hard to tell somebody to go fight a war with a country when you have communication with and you know what they're telling you is false.
Right.
And, you know, just like we know things just on the fly now with technology. Also with this Ray Kurzweil and this literature, how fast the technology is coming out. So our fear right now of the day of how the government is doing, what they're doing as far as trying to censor and control pretty much, but they also just want to make money, but also this tomorrow or next day will maybe create a new technology that goes way beyond our imagination that someone just created in their life.
Just to give a little bit of background for folks here who may be unfamiliar with, the gentleman that is being referred to is Ray Kurzweil, spelled K-U-R-Z-W-E-I-L. He calls himself a technologist. He's a thinker of grand technological visions. He's written a number of books. The one I've read is the Age of Spiritual Machines, but he's written a number of books along these. And there's also a documentary movie about the guy called Transcendental Man, which is on Netflix if you're interested in checking that out. He, in what I've read about him, I think he has a point, but I think he sometimes goes a little too far. By which I mean, in the case of, I'll mention the example of the book of his that I've read, The Age of Spiritual Machines, he was envisioning, and this may still come to fruition, machines that would not only develop intelligence within a year's time, but intelligence of such grand level that would dwarf not only any human, but perhaps all of humanity. That's the potential that he's kind of driving at. That, for that to happen, I think hinges on a lot of assumptions that he think he either ignores or blows over or thinks are going to happen just fine. I'll mention one critical example about this. In order for that to happen, and remember, a lot of the technological advances critically rely on a lot of good fortune, especially with the establishment of surplus energy. All the technologies that we've had, that we've used, with the exception of probably newspaper and print, and even there you could probably make a case for, have critically relied on the establishment of cheap, abundant, reliable sources of electricity. If that's not there, this computer I've got in front of me is basically worthless.
But you're based it on the technology of now, you see.
Right.
Because we know that tech people are, at this moment, in the crisis of the planet, want to save energy, they are creating better and efficient energy.
Right.
So it will be possible installed.
Yeah, and that's going to be a key question that's probably going to be answered in the next couple of decades. Will this advance in technology overcome the depletion of energies that we're seeing increasingly worldwide? And will we be able to somehow invent or create or somehow synthesize replacement energies to come up with that? The answer might be yes. I'm kind of thinking the answer is probably going to be no. The only way we'll know is to find out. And I think that that's, in order for his visions to come into some kind of fruition, I would think that that's going to rely a lot on that establishment, maybe a few lucky breaks along the way, in order for that to happen. Who knows? It might happen, and I may well be proved wrong, or I may be more right than I realize. The only way we know is going to find out, and also there are so many other factors and developments that could affect this that other people could bring into bear on this that could change this in directions no one could envision. So it's up for grabs. I'm kind of thinking, I think he's probably right to some point about the technology having an impact and probably in the immediate future, especially where, you know, that raid that happened a night and a half ago in Zuccotti Park in New York, most everyone, and in fact you could see live through web streams that they provided at Zuccotti Park, and I happened to be friends with the techs in Minneapolis who were providing that stream. And that's a great thing, the fact that people could see that without having to wait for CBS into the infinity day of infinity, where they would never ever provide that, but nonetheless people can see it no matter where they live if they happen to have a computer. But I think that's a little bit of a long way from seeing that kind of technologies and super intelligences that would emerge.
Okay. Just that point. What I mean is that from one of the points is chaos. Through chaos comes creation, because those who try to make a way, try to survive, mm-hmm. to a degree. So we feel that our voice is going to be muffled, going to be censored, going to be controlled. We, as people, through technology, is going to find a way to be heard. And I'm saying through technology, yeah. It's so fast that things coming out, that I think it would be amazing for them, because I can see the way that they're doing it as far as a government corporation, because
right.
If you can't get the politician to do it, we put our own person in there who will do it for us. That seems to be the way that most companies and the way the company's doing it now. What I'm saying is that also as far as our fear of control of the internet and the radio, whatever, that folks are creating ways themselves to say, okay, I'm not going to use WWW right. or use your ISP. I can go to Radio Shack and build my own. I can build my own server because I have my own audience. And I also think that could be a fear there, because we begin to create our own small societies, and within that own society, we shut out through our own mm-hmm. cultural differences.
Everything you said, I think, rings true. And this kind of echoes back to the point I made about radio earlier in the presentation. That yes, the technology is there, and yes, the fact that people can do that and change the world for the better is a great thing. And we should do everything we can to make sure that that ability is maintained and flourishes. We need more of that. Part of the struggle in maintaining that is going to be the political struggle over those media, including the policy fights over these media, the whole net neutrality thing that is the topic of this very presentation. And that's where that fight is still very much up for grabs. And I'm happy to report that the fact that people have been getting involved is a cause for optimism, especially where a lot of people thought that given the array of forces aligned to try to squelch this fight in its infancy, thought that they would succeed, and haven't, is very hopeful. We have unfortunately seen too many times in the history of this country and in the history of media worldwide where that potential promise of technology winds up getting squelched. And we have to do everything we can to try to preserve that for the internet. And that's where all this fight comes to play here.
One more.
Okay.
You used the example of radio and television, and as far as a lot of people's perspective, that they pretty much won those fights, because once David Powell got back in there, you know, he's changed a lot of the clip channels, walking through
Oh, no, no, no. I'm talking about the fights going back to the 1920s and 30s, but when CBS, NBC, and the National Association of Broadcasters.
Okay, but still, if the common person look at radio and television, you know, you only see a handful of public assets there versus the whole spectrum of other, you know, means of control there. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't seem like the fight in those arenas in radio and television was too successful.
They weren't successful, and that's what I'm getting at. There was, you know, once upon a time, about 80, 90 years ago, those media were of the kind of heady thinking that people think of the internet now. Television was not a good example because there it was squelched almost from the get-go. And the big reason why was because the fight for radio 20 years earlier wound up being a very heated terrain, and unfortunately lost. But that's where that's a very telltale lesson for us to learn now, that don't think that just because things are as they are now regarding the internet, that, you know, you and a laptop and a $200 studio and paying an internet service provider $100 a year can provide a voice and a resource that can change the world. Just because that's the case now doesn't mean that's going to be the case in the future. Just as radio broadcasters at the University of Arkansas in 1920 thought that they had a grand 100,000-watt radio station that would reach the seven surrounding states of Arkansas, and they thought they had it made. And yet within a decade, that station, never mind maybe 90% of community radio stations that were around in 1920 were dead completely by 1930, to no small extent over those policy decisions that were made behind closed doors with little public input and with a lot of people fighting mightily to try to overturn but unfortunately failed. I go through this in the presentation I go, but go on. Yeah.
We only have a couple of minutes left, so I would really love to go around and hear from folks and maybe like final thoughts and comments. Maybe
we should start. I don't really know what much to say. It just sounds like the capitalization of truth ultimately. Who has the money can dictate what is morally true and what's not.
That's a real fear, but people have fought that. And I mean, how much money does Occupy Wall Street compared to Wall Street? I'm just saying.
Yes, one of, I think, the older people in the room. This, as they said, it's censorship, everything. The newspapers, everything. And as a small, simple analogy, I have a simple phone bill, hardwired, cheap. I look at the phone bill, telephone became a real hot item. It got to be, everybody wanted one. An old-fashioned telephone. So now I make $3.20 worth of cost a month, because it's 0.03, I mean, it's a real deal. And I pay a $21 bill to AT&T, and they're not my long distance, I got a separate deal on that. Mm-hmm. If you go home and just look at that, yes, telephone is now common. Everyone can have one. I mean, $3 to AT&T and taxes, access fees, municipalities, my cousin next door. I mean, when you look at it, it's like, wow. For $3, I'm paying $21 in taxes and other charges. But he's down the road when the internet is all over. You will see a bill for probably $5 a month that'll cost you $100 because of the fees, and it'll all be regulated and controlled. And it's the same thing. Once something gets popular, everybody, oh, we're going to allow you to have it now, it's a fad. And then they bring them through taxes. The federal, the state, the county, everybody is in you. Just look at your phone and read all those ridiculous charges, including 3% World War II excise taxes. Still not. Next. Start on the literature bill, whatever it is. If it's big, will you?
And there was a serious struggle over the telephony in the 1890s after the patent on the telephone expired in 1894. There were a lot of independent phone companies. They probably provided 40% of the market. AT&T was scared out of their wits around 1907.
Mitch, well, I think we're going to go.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry.
And then you can,
yeah, yeah.
You
know, sure, sorry.
I guess I agree with what everyone's saying. I think it's just folks out there are pretty fine buying a $2,000 Apple or paying $100 for cable television, you know. So they don't, I don't think to lay the person to, well, other than myself being a technician and then myself being a programmer, a writer. So it's, you know, it's, it, we can see that to a degree, you know, but we need to, I guess, put that in layman terms and how that is going to affect those people.
Yeah.
Just want to have a few questions for the children for themselves.
For me, I very much agree with the importance of net neutrality. My only concern is making sure that whatever piece of legislation is currently in front of us is actually the best vehicle. So
yeah.
You mentioned all the loopholes and the wireless stuff. I just want to make sure that this Verizon piece that's coming up with the FCC rule that's in place there, is that something we can get behind, or do you think it should be different?
At the moment, I'm going to say yes, because an FCC law, however flawed, is better than no law at all. And that law, once there, can be improved, or hopefully should be improved. At least that's easier to do than to start with something from scratch. So I will provisionally say for the moment, yes, support the FCC, because they're going to be on the right side of history than not once this is all said and done, I think.
Well, I still do things the old-fashioned way. If I have a complaint about something, I call the radio station to talk to your host. If I have a complaint about school, I find a person who I should talk to. So I'm sort of in between. I've got to know some more about this, because I'm not planning to get a computer anytime soon. I'm still an old-fashioned person, but I can always calling on. I still do things the old-fashioned way. You know, they have come out from place. They, like, Bank of America was in a charge of money to use your debit cards. Well, they got so many complaints. I don't think they're not going to move.
Yep, they turned back on that policy.
Right. I just checked everything over with a fine tooth for my bills.
There's some sort of assistant
The best resource, I'll nationally, if you want to find out the latest as far as what's going on regarding net neutrality and whatever current actions, savetheinternet.com. I'll plug that as a resource, and with some bias, because some friends of mine helped to maintain that website. But it's probably the best thing out there for learning about what's going on now, and also for actions you can take in the here and now for things that are coming up. Certainly.
Gone.
You're not alone. $9 for 3 months, yeah, because
yeah.
We're at. But that, I'm happy to report, is and has been changing. And this is a fight that can be won, and we should do everything we can to, you know, help to build those alliances and connections and awareness.
I think the philosophical edge to the entire discussion is water versus gas. Is information a commodity for sale, or is it something that we all have a basic fundamental right to? You pay a water bill, but that water bill pays for the infrastructure and the processing plant, but it doesn't actually pay for the water we get for free. We pay, but we take it for granted that we can walk in at any tap in Chicago and turn on and there's the water. But our water bill is very low because what we're paying for is the infrastructure. Gasoline, on the other hand, we're paying for a service, we're paying for specific content that we get, and we use it that way. The question becomes, do you fundamentally believe that information is something that we should share freely, or something you should have to pay for to be able to get it? And I think fundamentally, I mean, the argument against all of this is that information should be free. And the internet was created on finances that were all public monies, just like the water pipes, just like the distillery, you know. And that if, and by and large, was the dark fiber. Most of the infrastructure built, even for the telecommunications, was built with public money. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, does another company have the right to then regulate the information that comes through these publicly created infrastructures?
I'll mention this to touch on briefly. Increasingly, and this is a very encouraging term, a turn of events that we are seeing in the last 5 years or so, more and more people and more entities, governments, institutions, are seeing the internet not as a communications resource, but increasingly as a utility in its own right. Because so much of life is increasingly migrated online, which means the internet, that's now increasingly seen as, you can't live without it. That means it's a utility. That means that, you know, it should fall under provisions about, you know, common access and relatively low cost and wide availability and the ability to consume what you want and to share with whom you want, obviously within the law, but I think most people can do that.
Oh,
you're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.